from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Miles Davis apparently said, timing isn't the main thing, it's the only thing. Which sounds so cool, but what is it really, timing? You need it to get a joke right or to deliver the bad news. It's knowing the moment, when to act. The writer Daniel Pink says it's one of those things that a lot of us can't explain very well, but, and I hope this doesn't ruin it, but timing is a thing, not a notion. There's a science to timing, a biology to it. And Pink says if we can figure that out, we can use it. Today in the program, Daniel Pink is joining us to talk about timing, which is about these patterns in our lives and how we can learn to sync them up with the world around us. His book is called When. Join us after the news.
On the next More to Say, most of the lawsuits filed in Utah are debt collection suits, usually in the realm of a couple hundred dollars. And 98.5% of debtors being sued don't get legal help. But if you don't answer the suit, and answer means something really specific here, you're giving all the power to the debt collector. There's a group of BYU students and their professor who are trying to help Utah debtors. Download the next episode of More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whether you can explain it exactly or not, you know what it means to have perfect timing. It seems mysterious, but for some reason, when you get it right, everything in the universe aligns and makes the moment perfect. The writer Daniel Pink started thinking about timing because at certain moments in his life, the decisions he was making, the work he was doing, was just off for some reason. And so he started to wonder if you could pin timing down, you know, measure it, map it, figure it out. Well, what he learned is that timing actually is a science, that there is a body of research in economics and anthropology and endocrinology that is explaining how timing works. So today in the program, Daniel Pink is joining us to talk about his new book. It's called When. He joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. to explain what he has learned about timing. And first off, he said, it's not just that timing is everything, but that everything is timing.
One of the things that we sometimes mistake about ourselves is our biological natures. So, you know, we are biological creatures, but we are also temporal creatures. We talk about a biological clock. Basically, what the truth is that we essentially have biological clocks in every cell in our body.
Yeah.
I mean, we move through the day in a predictable pattern, like many other species. We are living on a planet that is turning at a regular rate each day. So we're, you know, we're temporal creatures in a temporal environment. And so the idea that that isn't important, it seems, is, you know, when you take a step back, that's nonsense. And the good news in all of it is that we don't have to be the hostage of time and timing. Yeah. We can actually look at some of this research and make systematically better decisions about timing in many, many realms of our life.
So I want to ask you about, you begin the book with the story of the sinking of the British ocean liner, the Lusitania. This was in 1915. And contained in the story, the way you write about it, are these, well, two inexplicable decisions made by the captain. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this because they turned out to be fairly disastrous.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a good illustration of the idea of how timing plays out. Just mention this, if you would.
Sure. So what you had this very seasoned captain Turner, who was piloting the Lusitania. It was obviously a very tumultuous time. On the Germany had U-boats all over the place. People were warned, hey, you're going through the Atlantic Ocean in waters that might be dangerous. You might want to reconsider taking this trip. And what ultimately happened was that a U-boat, a submarine, sunk the Lusitania, and that was a catalytic event in World War I. And since then, there have been all kinds of explanations about what was really going on here, all kinds of conspiracy theories. Oh, Winston Churchill engineered the sinking of the Lusitania in order to lure the United States into it. The Lusitania was carrying a cache of arms, and that's, you know, that the Germans found out about. And And when I looked at that story, looking through the lens of the science of timing, I found something very different. What you had was a guy who made a couple of bad decisions, and I think that he could very well have made them because he made them at the wrong time of day.
Yeah.
He had not gotten any sleep the night before because he was on watch, and then he made his decisions in the early afternoon. And what we know from a mountain of research is that the early afternoon is a trough in our days, and we make systematically worse decisions. A lot of bad things happen in that trough, so it's not like so for me. I'm not a big believer in conspiracy theories because I don't think people are typically that organized and competent to pull them off.
Right.
And so when I look at this tale, I say, wait a second. This was a sleep-deprived guy who made a decision at the worst time – two decisions – at the worst time of day to make decisions. And what we know is – and it's obvious and manifest in the research on our day is that our cognitive abilities don't remain the same over the course of a day.
Yeah.
They change, and they change in systematic and predictable ways. And this fellow, Captain Turner, was in the stage of the day when research shows kids score worse on standardized tests.
Yep.
Doctors make more errors. We have more car accidents on the road. He was at the point of the day when we know from a mountain of research people often don't make very good decisions.
I love the bit of the research that we're we can track this pattern of a day through analyzing tweets.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some real – what's interesting about this research is, again, that you have different scholars in different fields using different methodologies all coming to a similar kind of conclusion. So this is – the research that you're mentioning, Doug, it was done by two Cornell sociologists, and they used a program called the – piece of software called the LIWC, the Linguistic Inventory Word Count. And essentially what this is a piece of software that can analyze giant bodies of text. So you have scholars in, say, literature who can use this to put in all of Charles Dickens's, all of, you know, every Dickens work and say, how often do women have speaking parts? How often do men have speaking parts?
Yeah, yeah.
How often is it light outside? How often is it dark outside? All kinds of very interesting large-scale analysis. What this program can also do is measure the emotional level of the words that are used. Is this word conveying a positive emotion, a negative emotion, or a neutral emotion? And so what these Cornell researchers did, which is totally intriguing, is they said, well, let's take a different – let's forget about Charles Dickens. Let's take tweets, and let's take a ginormous number of tweets. They ended up taking 500 million tweets, half a billion tweets from 2.5 million users. They put these tweets into this program to measure the emotional content, and then they plot them against time of day.
Yeah.
And what they were saying is, do our tweets reveal changes in our emotions over the course of the day? And the answer was yes, absolutely. And what they found was a pattern where we had a peak in the morning, higher mood in the morning, declining mood early in the afternoon.
That's
and then
the trough,
recovering
right?
mood later in the day.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A peak, a trough, and a rebound.
Right.
And when other scholars using other methodologies and other disciplines have done something similar, for instance, Daniel Kahneman, the famous psychologist mm-hmm. who won the Nobel Prize in economics, doing some work with Alan Krueger, an economist at Princeton who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Obama, they used a different methodology. What did they find? Morning peak, afternoon trough, late afternoon, early evening recovery. And so over and over again in the pattern of our mood, we see this up, down, up, peak, trough, recovery.
It's interesting. I have to say that there's a biological component to all of this. You mentioned the circadian rhythms. But there's also something else going on that I am fascinated by. And it's this idea that it's not just – this rhythm isn't just biological. There's something social or maybe cultural going on here too.
Sure.
That we are – our clock is connecting to external cues. It's this idea called entrainment.
Exactly.
Talk about that. This is really interesting.
So, there's some really kind of spooky. There's some really spooky research out there where chronobiologists will put people into, essentially benevolent caves that are sealed off from light
yeah.
and contact with other people. And it turns out that our daily rhythms are a little bit longer than 24 hours. And so what you'll see is that people will, when you put people in these kinds of settings for a long period of time, eventually their clock will go off because they're not getting the external cues, the social cues, hey, I got to go to work, yeah. The environmental clues, hey, the sun is coming up or setting. And so they will be essentially rising in the evening, sleeping in the morning, and their whole system will be messed up. So we have these biological rhythms, but we also, as you say, Doug, we entrain to external cues. They can be social or they can be environmental. And that helps. And there's obviously a social efficiency part of that. If everybody was, we do have work schedules, so we entrain to that. We do have light and dark, so we entrain to that. That helps our everything function smoothly. And so one of the things you see about timing, it is as exactly as you identify, this really interesting mix between biology and society. So the idea that we are purely biological creatures, that's the only thing driving us, isn't quite right. But the idea that biology doesn't matter is also not quite right. We are biological creatures in a social world, and that ends up predicting a lot of our behavior around timing.
I was surprised at how much of this seems to connect us to each other, how much of this idea of timing and our cycles and coming into being in sync with others was related to belonging and community, being together. It was amazing how kind of lovely these ideas were when I just thought of them as being abstract scientific concepts.
Yeah. I mean, time is inherently abstract. That's one of the challenges here. And so a lot of the things that we think of as natural units of time, like seconds or hours or weeks, they're not natural. There are efforts to wrestle down and make sense of these abstractions. But I do agree with you. At a deep level, there's something really intriguing going on. We see this in the research of how do groups synchronize in time, as you mentioned. So I looked at these men who deliver lunches in Mumbai, India.
Yeah. The Dabbawalas.
The Dabbawalas who were taking lunches from people's apartment, homemade lunches from people's apartments, delivering them to downtown Mumbai. 20 miles away without using technology, but completely synchronized to each other and to the train schedule and doing it without errors, or choral groups or rowers. And what you see is that when we work in sync with other people, there's something happens there. It makes us feel good. So if you look at the research on choral singing, it is extraordinary. I mean, I was blown away by how powerful the effects of our singing in a chorus, not singing alone. Not just singing, but singing in a group. So what you see is choral singing as a source of incredible mood boost. You see choral singing, research showing choral singing is a prophylactic against depression. You also see at the physiological level some remarkable things. So you have people sing in a chorus and then take their blood, their immunoglobulin levels, that is their immune response, goes up. Their pain threshold goes up. It's just extraordinary. And what's even more interesting, I think, is that when we have the experience of synchronizing with others, rowing, even little kids swinging in sync on swing sets or playing synchronous games with each other, or again, the big kahuna, choral singing, or even social dancing, when we do those things, we actually afterwards behave better. We are much more, in the parlance of the social psychologist, pro-social. We're more likely to do good. And so there's something profoundly human about synchronizing with others. It makes us feel good. It makes us do good.
You write about when we sync. There are three principles that you write about in terms of group timing. Syncing up to the boss.
Yes.
We need a pace setter. We need someone to, like when we're rowing. We need someone to say, now's the time to row. So we need that. Once we do that, you say that we sync up to the tribe. And this requires belonging. And I want to say a little bit more about this. You talk about this belongingness hypothesis, how important this is to shaping our thoughts and emotions. Say a little bit more about that part, because I found the syncing up to the tribe really interesting.
Yeah. This is actually a relatively new concept in the world of behavioral science and social psychology. A very famous psychologist, Roy Baumeister was one of the people who brought this to the fore. But the idea was is that belongingness is a fundamental part of what it is to be a human being, that we want to belong to something. That is, it affects our thoughts, it affects our emotions, and that its absence is hurts us in sometimes a physical way, but certainly in an emotional and psychological way. Now, it makes sense at some level from an evolutionary perspective, right? So when we were evolving, we're out there on the savanna evolving, in our early days as human beings, and you're not going to be able to make it on your own. You need your group in order to survive. So people who had that sense of belongingness, who both fostered that sense of belongingness and needed that sense of belongingness, were more likely to survive, and therefore they passed their genes further into the population, further down the genetic chain. But what we see in group synchronization is some certain aspects of belongingness. So these Dabbawalas who I talk about, mm-hmm. they all come from the same village, and they don't speak Hindi. They speak another language called Marathi. They have a system of codes in how they mark the lunches that they deliver. These codes are completely inscrutable to anybody else. They look like gibberish. They look like graffiti. But to them, it's this kind of internal language. One of the things that fosters belongingness also can be things like clothing. And so they wear they have incredible autonomy in how they do their work. But they all must wear this certain kind of hat that identifies them and that unifies them. And you even see things, some intriguing research. So it's things like certain kinds of languages, certain kinds of language, certain kinds of ritual, certain kinds of dress. There's some very interesting research from the NBA.
Yeah. About showing touch.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing. What this research showed is they had people watch videos early in the season of NBA games. And what the people watching these things didn't know what the researchers were looking at. They just were instructed to count. What I want you to do is count fist bumps, high fives, chest bumps, head slaps, head grabs, low fives, medium fives, hugs, half hugs, anything where the players touched each other. And then what the researchers did is they used that and said, and they found that teams that were more likely to touch actually performed better as the season went on. That there was something about touch that fostered this sense of belongingness. And so when we synchronize with other people, that there are these kind of levels, as you mentioned. We synchronize to a boss, and so that's why you have choral directors who have a reputation for being somewhat dictatorial. It's why you have coxswains on rowing boats. Mm-hmm. Again, if coxswains and choral and chorus leaders are actually, to me, very similar in that the chorus leader, the choir director, is the only person up there who's not making a sound. The coxswain is the only person out there who's not touching an oar and not doing any kind of the rowing. They're literally facing different directions from the people whom they're leading. Yeah. But having that sort of singular titular boss, it allows people to coordinate. Then when they coordinate to each other, they have a sense of belonging, which fosters that kind of coherence. And then they synchronize to the heart.
Yeah.
And that is actually both literal and metaphorical.
Right.
So what's really amazing is that when choral groups sing and you measure their heartbeats, their hearts start beating in sync. So, I mean, it's a literal thing that their hearts are beating at the same time. But as we were talking about before, synchronizing with other people makes us feel good, makes us do good. It's this virtual cycle of good feeling and good deed. And it's really just, I mean, I have never sung in a chorus. I've never spent much time around choruses. I'm not a rower. And so when I entered this world, I was really just blown away by the power of group synchronization.
So to give people a sense of just how important timing is, you mentioned the study that was done on these Danish school children, like 2 million Danish school children.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pretty big study.
Big data.
Yeah, big data. Talk a little bit about this, because it found students scored higher in the morning than in afternoons, which seems obvious, I guess. But you say that the effect of later in the day testing was equal to missing out on about 2 weeks of school in a year, or having parents who had less education or less income. That is to say, this idea of timing can be really critical at this stage.
Exactly, and this is the key point. And you know we somehow have a belief, or we never challenge the assumption, that our cognitive abilities, our brain power, remains the same throughout the day. Mm-hmm. It does not. It changes, and there's pieces of evidence of this. And the Danish study is really interesting for a number of reasons. It's first of all, the size, as you mentioned, Doug, it's 2 million students.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the way they were able to figure this out was this, that students in Denmark take standardized tests on computers rather than on, you know, bubble sheets and number two pencils, as we often do here in the States. And the challenge, though, is that the typical Danish school has more students than computers, so everybody can't take the test at the same time. So they're randomly assigned to take the test at different times of day. And lo and behold, students who took the test in the afternoon scored as if they'd missed 2 weeks of school. Now, that should be alarming to us because we make decisions on education policy based on standardized tests, and there's a ginormous time of day effect. Yeah. What's even more alarming to me, at least, is that what if we make decisions about a particular student based on her standardized test scores, and if she had been randomly assigned to the morning, she would have had a different set of scores.
Yeah.
And so this is just more, and we see this in the corporate world, where public company earnings calls are more negative and irritable when they're in the afternoon rather than in the morning, even if you control for what the fundamentals are, and it leads to a mispricing of the stock. And you see this in very alarming ways in healthcare. Anesthesia errors are four times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. Doctors find half as many polyps in colonoscopies and afternoon exams as they do in morning exams. Hand washing in hospitals deteriorates significantly in the afternoon. Physicians are more likely to prescribe unnecessary antibiotics in the afternoon than in the morning. And so, you know, the evidence is just screaming out at us that time of day has an effect on how we perform.
Do you think we should be rethinking the day? I mean, this is going to require some kind of crazy cultural shift. But in some ways, that is what you're suggesting, is we need to rethink the way we think of a day.
I think that we do, and here's a way to think about it. So again, let me take a step back here. So we've talked about the peak, trough, and recovery.
Yep.
What we know is that most of us move through the day in that order: peak, trough, recovery.
Yep.
People who are strong evening people, night owls, people who go to sleep late, wake up late, they tend to go in their reverse order. But what we know from, again, a wide variety of research is this: during the peak, we should be doing our analytic work. Work that requires heads down, focus, and attention, in particular, vigilance. That's the word that comes up in all this research.
Right.
During our peak, which for most of us is the morning, we're better able to bat away distractions. Right? During the trough, which we've talked a lot about, that's not good for very much. And so that's when we should be doing our administrative work, answering our routine emails, doing all that sort of thing in the course of a workday that doesn't require enormous creativity or enormous focus.
Yeah.
Then later in the day is for most of us, the recovery, which for most of us is later in the day. For owls, it's in the morning. For the recovery period is really interesting. We know from the Twitter research and the Kahneman research that our mood is improving later in the day, but we're less vigilant than we are during the peak.
Right.
And that combination of reduced vigilance and higher mood makes it a good time for creative work, for brainstorming. So it's pretty clear we should be doing analytic work in the peak, administrative work in the trough, and creative work in the recovery. And here's the problem, Doug. And you see this in every organization, all right? So let's talk about scheduling meetings.
Yeah.
People inside of white-collar offices spend a huge amount of their time in meetings. And when any organization schedules meetings, they use only one criterion, and that is availability. Who's available?
Yep.
All right?
Yeah.
And so we don't think, oh, what kind of meeting is this? Does it require focus and analytic thinking? Are we going over the financial report? Is it just a purely administrative meeting? Do we need to do some brainstorming here? What kind of people are going to be at this meeting? Are they people who have their peak in the morning or people who have their peak later in the day? And the mistake that we're making, so what happens is that you have offices where full of people who are better able to do their analytic work in the morning, and the boss schedules a 9:30 meeting about the travel voucher policy, right in the middle of their peak period.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I talked to an executive at a big technology company who was saying, gosh, we had our major product review meeting the other day, and it really was kind of bad. It didn't go very well. Well, when was it? 2:00 in the afternoon. And I'm like, okay, that's when you should be having your travel voucher policy meeting.
Yep.
And the point of all this, and I think if there's one takeaway from this research for our own lives, it's this. It has to do with being intentional. We are very intentional about what we do. You know, I have today, you know, this morning on a piece of paper with a pencil, I wrote my to-do list, right? Mm-hmm. We're intentional about what we're going to do. We're intentional about who we do it with, how we do it. But when it comes to when we do things, we're just not very intentional. We don't think that it matters. And it matters. I mean, just, you know, time of day alone explains about 20% of the variance, the difference in how people perform on the job. So again, to your earlier point, does that mean that timing is everything? No. But it means it's a big thing, and it's something that we should be intentional and take seriously.
I wanted to ask you about chronotypes. I found this really interesting. You write about how that we all have these different internal clocks. Some of us are night owls. Some of us are larks. But it turns out, and this was interesting, I hadn't realized, most, you say, aren't in fact owls or larks, but we're the third bird.
Yeah. We're kind of in the middle.
In the middle, that's true.
Yeah. That's true for a lot of things, a lot of human qualities. So if you look at something like the measures of introversion and extroversion. You know, we tend to look at it in this very binary way, but if you actually look at the research on introversion and extroversion, what you find is that some of us are strong introverts, but not that many. Some of us are strong extroverts, but not that many. Most of us are in between, what are called ambiverts. We're a little bit of both.
Yeah.
And that turns out to be true for this as well. So about 15% of us in this distribution, 15% of us are very strong early people.
Yeah.
Wake up early, go to sleep early. About 20% of us are very strong late people, owls. And owls, very, the whole world is constructed to crush the spirit of owls, I think, unfortunately. And owls are, there's some people who are very, very extreme owls. So the distribution isn't a bell curve. But 2 out of 3 of us are in the middle.
Yeah.
2 out of 3 of us are in the middle. And that that propensity determines whether we go through peak trough recovery or recovery trough peak. And about 80% of us go through the day peak trough recovery. We're just going to have the peak at, you know, slightly different times of the morning.
Well, what's interesting is the way you talk about what we do with that. Then you say, okay, so what we should do is figure out our chronotype. Mm-hmm. Determine what it is we're trying to accomplish, and then figure out, you say, the optimal time of day for doing this. Talk a little bit about that, because this is where we get into this point where you talk about how important it is to take a break, how important a nap is.
Mm.
Say something about that. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So what we're looking for is what psychologists call the synchrony effect. You want to match up your type and your time and your task. So you have to figure out, are you a lark or an owl or in between? Again, there are very easy ways to figure that out. There are very simple ways to figure that out. I also think most people have an intuitive sense of that.
Yeah. Let me just say something about that, because you do mention this. You say basically you say, what time do you, like if you, like on a Saturday Sunday, you do it.
Yeah,
take
we
us through
do,
that. Yeah, yeah.
We could do, we could do it for you, Doug, because I have no idea what the answer is. So I want you to think about a free day. This is what chronobiologists call a free day, which is basically a day you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock. For a lot of us, it's a weekend. And don't think about catching up on sleep.
Right.
You know, to think about, it's like, just what's your natural state. So on a free day, when would you typically go to sleep?
I would go to sleep around 10 o'clock. Yeah, pretty
early. When would you typically wake up?
Never past 6 in the morning.
Oh, my. Okay, so let's say you go to sleep at 10 and wake up at 6. Yeah. So what we're figuring out here on your free day is the midpoint of sleep.
Right.
And your midpoint of sleep is 2 a.m., so you are definitely a lark.
Yeah.
I hope that – does that ring true to you?
Oh, totally. I mean, I have to be for this show.
Right, right.
Yeah,
so, but it could be that – yeah, I mean – so we know, okay, you're going to go through the day peak trough recovery. And again, what we know is that our cognitive abilities don't stay the same over the course of a day. So during the peak, which for you is the morning, analytic work, like interviewing people about sophisticated topics.
Right.
During the trough, That's when you should be answering your routine email, filling out your expense report, whatever.
Yep.
And then during the recovery later in the day, that's maybe when you should be thinking, brainstorming ideas for shows down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what we see is that if we just make some small changes in our own lives, push the right work to the right time, we boost our creativity, we boost our productivity, and we're happier. But we have to be intentional about it.
That's Daniel Pink. His new book is called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Daniel Pink, who has a new book that's exploring the science of timing. It's called When. How important is a nap?
You know what? Naps, in some ways, naps are interesting. The whole world of breaks is really interesting, too. We have absolutely undersold breaks. Naps, I think, are a component of breaks. My view is that breaks are where sleep was 15 years ago. The science of naps was where the science of sleep was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, people who came into an office, you know, oh, I pulled an all-nighter. Oh, I haven't gotten any, you know, more than 2 hours of sleep for 3 weeks, were seen as heroic.
Yeah.
Then the science of sleep came out. And it penetrated the popular consciousness. And we know, okay, that sleep-deprived dude over there, he's not a hero. He's a fool.
Right.
He's hurting his performance. He might even be hurting our performance.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to work with people like that.
Yeah.
And so what we have is breaks, I think, are where sleep was 15 years ago. The science of breaks, which is emerging, is fascinating. And I think it offers some powerful lessons and some guidance for us. At a top level, it's this. That we, and this is, you know, Americans, just, you know, no matter where you come from, no matter what your religious faith, no matter where your parents or grandparents or ancestors were from, how they got to this country, every American has this dose of puritanical thinking in them, you know, and where we think that, you know, this idea of powering through, I'm feeling a little tired, I got to power through, is morally virtuous and practically effective. And it's just not the case. Powering through is not a good idea. And what we see is that we have to start thinking of breaks not as a deviation from performance, not as a concession, not as a sign of weakness, but as part of performance. In the same way that elite musicians are very diligent about taking breaks, elite athletes are very diligent about taking breaks. Breaks are part of our performance. And we should be taking more breaks, and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. Now, let me steer back to the idea of a nap.
Yeah.
There's some good research on naps, and for me at least, it was revelatory.
Because you hate naps, or hated them.
Well, I tend to hate naps because, you know, I wake up from a nap, I feel terrible.
Right.
I mean, I feel groggy, but I also feel ashamed of myself. You know, that's
right.
Back to the puritanical strain in the Pink family.
Yep.
And so, and it turned out I was doing it wrong. The ideal nap, research tells us, is extremely short. I was surprised by this. The ideal nap is about 10 to 20 minutes long. If you nap for that amount of time, you get the restorative effects of a nap without what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy feeling you get when you wake up from a longer nap. So the ideal nap is between 10 and 20 minutes long. And this is another way that we can take a break. But once again, we need to be much more intentional about taking breaks. Breaks are part of our performance. Breaks improve our performance. They're not, and at some level, Doug, I'm saying this to myself because, you know, at a deep level, I'm not sure I believe it intellectually. I'm not sure I fully believe it viscerally. Breaks are good, that we need more breaks and we need certain kinds of breaks.
Well, you mentioned one researcher who said that for students, that they should have one break every hour.
Yeah.
And you could actually see test scores go up.
Yeah, well, I mean, so there's some very, very interesting examples of that. So you mentioned the Danish study where scores in the afternoon were equivalent to missing 2 weeks of school. The remedy for that, it turned out, was if you give these kids a 20 to 30 minute break to run around, maybe get a snack before they take that test, scores go back up.
Yeah.
You see some evidence out of Finland. Finland has hourly breaks. It's a high-performing school system, as many of us know. I mean, it's unclear whether that's the only, obviously it's not the only reason, but sure. they're systematic about breaks. There's some very interesting emerging research on recess, which again, in many districts and many jurisdictions, in the name of rigor, we try to get rid of recess. Oh, we got to have these kids focused. We got to have these kids, you know, locked down studying math and reading and science and all those kinds of good things. So we need to sacrifice recess. There's some interesting research in some low-income school districts in Texas where they're actually have seen improvements in test scores, as you say, by introducing more recesses. Because again, breaks are part of our performance. They're not a concession. They're not a weakness. They're not a deviation from performance.
There's a section in the book where you write about beginnings, middle points, and ends.
Yes.
Let's talk about why do beginnings matter so much?
Well, there's a lot of evidence showing that begin on a number of different dimensions. There's a lot of evidence showing that how something begins shapes its overall trajectory. Yeah. I don't think that's an especially new idea, but I think that the significance and potency of it is surprising. You see this in the research from Lisa Kahn at Yale, who looked at the years in which people graduate from college. So you've got somebody who graduates from college in a boom economy, somebody who graduates from college in a recession. They're similarly situated. And not surprisingly, the person who, I think we understand a person who graduates in a more robust economy is going to have an easier time finding that first job and so forth. What I think what's surprising and in some level even shocking is that that shows up in their wages 20 years later. Wow. That you can actually impart, you can predict part of people's wages for college graduates. You can predict part of their wages by what the unemployment rate was when they graduated from college. That's how much beginnings can shape us. You see this in some MBA programs where, students who get an MBA in a recession are actually less likely to become CEO of a large company. Even if you control for everything else, ability and everything else, they're less likely to become CEO of a large company because that initial starting point, that beginning, changed their trajectory.
Now, here's the thing that's nice about this idea is you say that we can start again. I mean, there is a way for us to find a way to start. So if you get off to a bad start, which is important, you can kind of course correct.
Yeah, in many cases, for this, graduating in a recession, that's a harder thing.
That
may require a more comprehensive solution. But many of us, let's say I want to start a new exercise regimen, and I try it, and it doesn't really work very well. So should I just declare failure forever? No, I want to start. I want to restart. I want to reboot. But it turns out that all days of the year are not created equal. This is some fascinating research from the University of Pennsylvania. Katie Milkman and Jason Reese and Heng Chen Dai have done some research on what are called temporal landmarks.
Right.
There are certain dates that stand out in time the way physical landmarks stand out in space. What do physical landmarks in space make us do? Slow down and pay attention. And these temporal landmarks have that effect. But what they also do is they trigger this peculiar form of mental accounting where, business at the beginning of a quarter or the beginning of a fiscal year will open up a fresh ledger. And so on certain of these dates, what they call fresh start dates, we open up a fresh ledger on ourselves. We relegate our bad selves to the past and say, oh, new me is going to be really awesome. And so the most robust example of this is New Year's Day and New Year's resolutions.
Right.
But there are other ones that are not quite as potent, but close. So, and it gives us some guidance, again, on how to use the temporal aspects of our lives to live a little better. So if you want to start a new exercise plan or a new diet, you're actually better off, you're more likely to start and more likely to sustain it if you start it on a Monday rather than on a Thursday, on the first of the month rather than on the 12th of the month, on the day after your birthday rather than 3 days before your birthday, that we can use these fresh start dates to reboot and restart from rocky beginnings.
Let's talk about midpoints for a moment. This is really interesting. You talk about how we all get to these midpoint slumps. And in some ways, you say this could be more about biology than sociology, which I hadn't really thought of this as a biological thing, that there's something biological about having a kind of midlife or midpoint crisis.
Yeah, yeah. We don't really have much of a crisis, but we do have a slump. And what's interesting about this, I don't have a good answer to that, Doug. I mean, one of the things is I looked at the research on the midlife crisis and found
it's overstated.
It's overstated largely because it's non-existent.
Right.
So to state anything is to overstate it. It's one of these ideas that is just, you know, broken out of the barn and is galloping all over the place. And I want to just lasso it and bring it back in and say, whoa, don't take this seriously.
Yeah.
But what we do see, which I think is very significant, is this midpoint slump.
Sure.
What we can think of as a U-shaped curve for well-being, meaning that we're happier in our 20s and 30s, dip in happiness in our 40s, really bottom in our 50s, and then rise back up in our 60s, 70s, if we're alive, 80s and 90s. And I think what's interesting about that pattern is that if I were to show you the curve, lifetime curve of well-being, give you three charts. Here's the curve. Here are three charts. Tell me which one is from the United States, which one is from Hungary, and which one is from the United Arab Emirates. You would not be able to tell the difference. This pattern is replicated in something like 70 countries. So there is something. I don't know what's going on here, but there is that slump in the middle, which we see in other kinds of behavior too. There's certain kinds of things where certain kinds of tasks and things where people lose their diligence in the middle. They slump in the middle. They're less compliant in the middle. You see it in a whole variety of behavior on, you know, on things like the lighting of Hanukkah candles.
Yeah.
So it's an 8-night holiday where Jews light candles night 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And when you actually look at behavior, you find that people light them religiously, no pun intended, on night 1 and night 8, but end up slumping in the middle of those things. You have people cut out shapes. You know, please cut out these 5 shapes according to this pattern, or these 7 shapes according to this pattern. People will be very diligent on the first one and very diligent on the 7th one, but 3 and 4, they'll kind of, you know, cut corners. Again, that's actually pun intended.
So
there's something about midpoints that bring us down. On the other hand, midpoints can have the exact opposite effect.
Well, and this is the thing that you get to. You say, look, we should be aware of the midpoints.
Yes.
But use them as wake-up calls. And then
absolutely.
Talk about how great coaches use midpoints, because this was a really good analogy, I have to say. The idea of going into halftime and saying, you know, imagining you're behind, but only by just a little.
Yeah, this is. I find this really powerful, and again, it comes out. You know, one of the reasons there's a fair amount of research in sports is that sports creates enormous amounts of data that's publicly available.
Yeah,
and so these research. So these two researchers, Jonah Berger and Devin Pope. Jonah is at Penn, and Devin is at Chicago. University of Chicago, they looked at tens of thousands of NBA games. Now, I think the NBA is a very interesting way to study midpoints, because in a basketball game, you have a distinct, clear midpoint. A lot of times, midpoints are invisible. We're not aware of them. But in basketball, you know, we have first quarter, second quarter, this thing called halftime. It's the midpoint. Then third quarter and fourth quarter. And what these researchers found is that teams that were leading at halftime were more likely to win the game. That's not a surprise mathematically. They have more points and the game's half over.
Yeah.
But there's an exception to that, and that exception was this. Teams that were behind, trailing by 1 point, were more likely to win the game than teams that were ahead by 1 point. Being behind by 1 point is as advantageous as being ahead by 2 points at halftime. And there was a less, we're heading into March Madness, there was less of an experience, less of an effect in NCAA games, but similar. And then in experimental research, again, big data gives us correlations. It doesn't tell us necessarily why things are happening. They found that if you put people into experimental settings, that if, you know, games and other kinds of contests and things, and give them and tell them at the midpoint of the contest, you're way ahead. People get complacent. You tell them you're way behind, people give up. You tell them you're a little bit behind, people just bring it in that second half.
Yeah.
There's something very motivating about being a little bit behind at the midpoint. And I think I think that managers can use this, teachers can use this, parents can use this effect very clearly.
That's Daniel Pink. His new book is called When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Daniel Pink. We're talking about his new book, When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Let me finally ask you about an aspect of timing you write about, and that is the way we think about the past and the way we think about the future. We're told not to dwell on the past, but you talk about this research that says that thinking about the past, in fact, can give us a greater understanding of ourselves, gives us empathy, fosters positive moods. Talk a little bit about this part. I thought this was really interesting, too.
Yeah, I find this also extremely interesting. And there's an emotion. It's been studied in some of the psychology of nostalgia, and which is basically thinking about the past in a somewhat tender way.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that is that nostalgia in the 17th and 18th century was thought to be a disease.
Right.
I mean, it's really kind of amazing.
Yeah.
They actually thought it was, all these crazy theories about, it's an oversupply of black bile in the blood. It's something that only Swiss people suffer from.
Yeah.
And there's been so now we've sort of gotten to a more scientific view of this. And the benefits of thinking fondly about the past are twofold, and they're essential in our well-being as human beings. One of them is a sense of meaning and also a connection to others. And so one of the things about the way we think about the past in terms of our present or future and the way that we reckon with our well-being, and this is a surprise to me as well, is that we're often told live in the present. And there's advantages of that psychologically.
Sure.
But what I found in looking at this research is that the highest sense of well-being is to integrate past, present, and future. Mm. And so if you think nostalgically about the past, what that does is that gives you a sense of meaning and a connection to other people, and you begin to integrate that past with your present. And the same thing is true with thinking about the future. And so how we actually think about time can shape our well-being. It can also shape our behavior in some intriguing ways.
Well, and this was one of my favorite little bits of research here is that, so there are some languages that draw a sharp distinction between the past and the future. And then there are other languages that basically the way the language works, there is no contrast. There's no distinction.
Right.
And the difference in the way people thought about the future in those two different languages is really fascinating.
This is I'm so glad you mentioned that because I love this piece of research. As it happens, way back when I was a linguistics major in college, so anything dealing with like the structure of language, I find endlessly fascinating. This one, I read this paper multiple times. I checked it with other scholars just to make sure. Okay, is this really right? And it's rock solid. It's from Keith Chen. At UCLA, he was actually an economist. And exactly as you're saying, Doug, what he did is that he grouped languages into two categories. One that had – some languages have a strong future, clear delineation. So in English is a strong future language. So when I say, I don't say I go to this – I can say I go to this store. But if I say I will go to this store, it's very clear that I'm talking about another time.
Yep.
Other languages are murkier, and people figure out past and present by the context.
Yeah.
So Mandarin would be an example of that. And what he found, and this is just mind-boggling, is that people who spoke languages that did not make a strong distinction between the future and the present, did not have these highly marked tenses, were more likely to save for retirement and less likely to smoke.
Yes.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And it has to do, we think, with this integration of the past and the present, or really with the present and the future. There's other research showing, for instance, let's take retirement savings. We tend to be terrible at retirement savings in general if we're left to our own devices. Mm-hmm. Hal Hirschfield is also at UCLA, did this interesting research where he got to the bottom of this, and he said one of the reasons that people don't save for retirement is they think that, you know, for you, future Doug, you know, 85-year-old Doug is a totally different person. Yeah. Like, why should I save for that guy?
Right.
And by showing people age-advanced photographs of themselves, hey, Doug, here's what you're going to look like when you're 85. People look at that, and boom, they start saving for retirement. So it's, again, it's that how we if we think about the past, present, and future as integrated, we actually make better decisions about our future. We're also, in general, happier. It gives our lives a sense of meaning, a sense of connection to others, and at some level, a sense of coherence.
We're essentially out of time, but I have to ask you about what was one of my favorite ways of perceiving time or the idea of time, and that is how the effect of awe, seeing something remarkable, the birth of a child, watching a thunderstorm, how that basically changes our perception of time. Say something
it
about
does.
That, finally, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it's connected to all of these kinds of things. So when we experience awe, and it's an emotion, powerful emotion, it's not that well studied in the literature. Jennifer Ocker at Stanford has done some good work on this, but it's not particularly well studied. And what awe does is that it seems to slow time down, to expand time. We feel like we have more of it, and that lifts our well-being. And what it does is that it's once again this sort of integrator between the future and the present and the past. And I think that altogether, that's in some ways what it means to live a good life. That is, if we bring if we understand how the past, present, and future integrate, we have a sense of meaning, we have a sense of connection to others, and it lifts our well-being significantly. But we have to be, going back to my favorite word of all time, intentional. Yeah. We have to be intentional about that. So we have to look for moments of awe. We have to think about ourselves as temporal creatures in a temporal world. And if we're intentional about our timing decisions, how we think about time, how we organize our day, how we reckon with beginnings, middles, and ends, there's no question to me that it's going to allow us to work better. But at a broader level, I think it's going to allow us to be just happier.
That's Daniel Pink. His book is When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Daniel, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program was directed by Tim Slover. Our thanks also to Claire Jones. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.